KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Daly City, otherwise known as Little Manila.
Lower Haight.
Outer Richmond.
Fremont.
South of Market.
The Marina.
The E.
Coming up, legalized recreational marijuana is just a few months away. Is the Bay Area ready?
While San Francisco has created an office of cannabis, it has yet to create new laws to locally regulate marijuana.
Then comic Daya Lakshmi Narayanan talks about how she sharpened her comedy skills while working as a venture capitalist.
I could take it and I would give it even harder, which probably you're not supposed to do.
And we'll hear a firsthand perspective from an ex-offender who became homeless from our friends at Stories Behind the Fog.
I've never done this in my life, but you know, I was hurting, I was hungry.
That story and more today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. Pot smokers all over the state are looking toward January 1st, when the plant will be legally available to adults. It was made possible last election when Prop 64 passed. But there are some major snags. The San Francisco County Board of Supervisors said last week it won't be ready to issue business permits on New Year's Day, and they haven't said when that might happen. So what's going on? KALW's Stephen Short is here to tell us. He's been following this topic for KALW for years now. So, Stephen, what's the holdup?
Well, Hannah, while San Francisco has created an office of cannabis, it has yet to create new laws to locally regulate marijuana.
Okay, but they knew this was coming. Why isn't the city government ready?
Well, let's just say it's complicated. In addition to those local regulations, city officials also want to create an equity program to help low-income entrepreneurs, people of color, and former drug offenders to get into this new industry. That's not a new concept. It's similar to what Oakland's been doing with their marijuana equity program.
Mm-hmm.
And unlike other states, including Nevada, where cannabis is totally legal now, the California system provides for local controls as well as state controls. David Downs reported last week in the Chronicle that because of this, not one major California city has created or issued a local license to sell recreational pot.
Oh, wow, not one. So what does this slow start mean for marijuana regulation?
Having these rules in place is crucial because any business dealing in cannabis needs that local license before they can get one from the state.
Where does that leave medical users?
Well, the State Bureau of Cannabis Control says people with medical cannabis cards will see little, if any, change after the first of the year. So steady as she goes with that.
Okay. So can you explain the difference, though, between medical cannabis and recreational cannabis once these new regulations go into effect?
Well, for one thing, I need to correct you because people in the field are transitioning away from the term recreational and replacing it with adult use.
Oh, okay. A lot to keep up with.
I know, and these are just the terms, not even the specifics.
Right.
I think this shift is because state regulations have merged into one office, so the distinction as to why it's being used doesn't matter. If you're an adult, it can be to feel better or simply to feel better.
I guess I still don't get the real differences here.
Oh, should I pull out my PowerPoint presentation?
No, Stephen. No. I think I'm fine.
Oh, well,
that won't work.
Well, then it's a good idea that I connected with Gaynell Rogers about this. She's a national media relations expert who has been in this field for about 9 years. Harborside Health Center in Oakland is one of her clients. She gave me a lot of details, but it boils down to this.
Okay.
Medical cannabis usually has a low THC content. That's the chemical compound that gets you high or feeling euphoric, to again use the preferred term. And in place of that, it has higher amounts of CBD, another cannabis compound that people use for anxiety, arthritis, childhood seizures, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and in that regard, the Food and Drug Administration announced yesterday that they're concerned about certain marijuana health claims, especially concerning cancer. So that's an area to keep an eye on.
Okay, so isn't there a tax difference, too?
That's right, yes. Some states, Colorado, for example, tax adult-use marijuana, but not medical. Earlier this week, the state's Bureau of Cannabis Control announced business taxes for cannabis sales and cannabis products, but there's no mention of medical versus adult use.
So come January 1st, it will still only be legal to sell marijuana at medical dispensaries, but anyone over 21 can use it. Is that right?
Use it is the operative term here. You can use it if you can find it, but it's illegal to buy it or sell it.
Okay, that's...
Does that make any sense to you?
That's confusing. Sounds like a riddle from elementary school.
Yeah, but it doesn't have a funny ending. I'm sorry. But as we've discussed, no recreational dispensaries will be operational in January. Medical dispensaries will continue to operate as they do now. And while any adult will be able to consume it, there are lots of restrictions on smoking it. One example, state law will make it illegal to smoke in public places, and the same rules that apply to tobacco pretty much apply to marijuana.
So what about smoking at home? Can you smoke at home?
Now, wouldn't you think that the privacy of your own home would seem like a logical answer?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's true if you own the home, but if you're renting an apartment, then you might have problems. Because if the landlord says no smoking, then that applies to anything. And remember that marijuana is still a felony on the federal level, so it's an illegal activity as far as the property owner is concerned.
So if you're a responsible adult and you want to consume pot, what do you do?
Well, the fastest growing segment of cannabis products is what's known as edibles. That's anything you ingest by mouth. While there's no smell or smoke related to edibles, the majority of these products are extremely potent, and I can't stress that enough. Lots of people have horror stories around their first time with edibles.
So like brownies?
Brownies, they're still around, but they're kind of old school. They're chocolate bars now, gummy bears.
Gummy bears.
Very tasty little things.
And you can't eat just one.
Well, you're supposed to. Some of these, you're not even supposed to eat a whole one. But, yeah, you're not likely to.
Mm-hmm.
There's the delayed effect, too. If you eat something, it's going to take half an hour or more to get through your system, by which time you might have eaten another one or two, and you see the problem.
Right.
And that's partly why the California Department of Public Health has just added a very helpful fact sheet to their website titled, Let's Talk Cannabis. It's a good read, especially for inexperienced users. Mm-hmm. You might want to read it before going to the county fair next summer, too.
County fair? Why?
Well, you know, it's traditional at these fairs, of course, to sample all kinds of things that you wouldn't otherwise.
Okay.
One of the cannabis rules that will be in effect in January allows for the properly licensed sampling of edibles. But again, no smoking, and adults only.
Corn dogs and churros not included.
No, but be assured there'll be plenty of cures for the munchies while you're there.
Thanks, Stephen. We'll check in with you again soon, I'm sure.
My pleasure.
That's KELW's Stephen Short, who compiles our Cannabis News Roundup. He posts new content on Fridays, and you can find it under the Cross Currents tab at KELW.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KELW News. I'm Hannah Baba. The People's Kitchen Collective in Oakland provides free, hot, nutritious breakfasts to people twice a year. The next one is scheduled a week from Saturday, when the group will be part of the 10th Youth Speaks Life is Living Festival at Defermery, or Little Bobby Hutton Park. Producer Meredith Hoddenott went to a previous breakfast to record the event and the thoughts of the people who run the program, Jocelyn Jackson, Saqib Kaval, and Sita Korotomi Bamik.
Blessings everyone that's here. Thank you so much. We start our meals with a blessing because it matters, because our ancestors knew how to sing their freedom into existence. Yes!
So People's Kitchen Collective is it's a collective of chefs and artists and activists, and we exist at the intersection of food justice and food service, but also art and community organizing.
In serving a free breakfast program to honor the legacy of the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense and their revolutionary free breakfast program that they started 50 years ago this month.
They serve breakfast free every day because they knew the political significance of bringing people together to eat, specifically bringing youth together to eat a healthy meal every day. And that was dangerous. The FBI The head of the FBI said that the free breakfast program was the most dangerous domestic threat to national security because eating breakfast and being healthy was dangerous to the state, and it still is. That is why we have food deserts. That is why we don't get access to healthy food in our communities. And that is why us coming together to eat a healthy meal and eat breakfast together is still a revolutionary act.
The reason why it is so powerful is because when a child especially is fed, when they are full of a good hot meal, they are also full of the ability to liberate themselves and to find self-determination in a way that's simply not possible when you are hungry.
People's Kitchen is really about drawing on this legacy of the Black Panther Party for self-defense and thinking about how is it that we can actually nourish and sustain our communities.
You know, we do this on an incredibly small budget, and we do it all as volunteers, so it takes a lot of food costing and math and planning to have a organic meal using local ingredients that's seasonal and also culturally specific, and replicating kind of the menus of the free breakfast program from the research that we've done.
And today we have grits, greens, scrambled eggs, and scrambled tofu, and these delicious sweetheart biscuits that are actually heart-shaped.
Some sweetheart sweet potato biscuits. There you go. A little extra one for extra love.
Being able to speak with everyone as they're going through the line.
Thank you.
It's really a powerful experience to feel the positive impact of what we're doing in real time.
I will not bow down to racism. I will not bow down to injustice.
I think overall, my favorite part is the Young Gift and Black Poets. When the poets get on the stage, then I know, like, oh, we are at the breakfast. Because these youth poets, like, they are, you know, I feel like the perfect representation of the free breakfast program come to life and the Black Panthers' original work around the free breakfast program doing youth-centered, you know, food work.
That piece was recorded by KALW's Meredith Hodnott. A week from Saturday, the People's Kitchen Collective will serve free grits and greens at DeFirmary, or Lil Bobby Hutton Park in Oakland. It's part of the 10th Life is Living Festival being thrown by Youth Speaks. You can find all this information at KALW.org. Click Cross Currents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Now we'll hear a story from our partners at Stories Behind the Fog, a multimedia project that puts human faces on the problem of homelessness. After 23 years in prison, Cherry Frazier moved into a halfway house in San Francisco. She expected to stay the length of her parole, 5 years. But 3 years in, something happened to change that plan. Cherry sat down with Ariana Vanderplas to share her experience.
So I was released May 24, 2013. And then I was sent to 111 Taylor, which was a halfway house, to find housing. And when I reached my 3-year mark on my 5-year maximum parole, my parole officer didn't tell me that he had filed the paperwork. On a Tuesday, the next Thursday, he comes and knocks on my door at 8, 9 o'clock at night, and he's like, has a UA cup in his hand. I said, okay, I'm ready, you know, because I don't use drugs, I don't drink, I don't do any of those things. And he goes, you haven't heard? So my heart fell a little bit. I was like, heard what? Mm-hmm. He says, you've been discharged off of parole. So I go to work the next morning at 9 o'clock, and when I come home at 5 o'clock, I couldn't get in the door. They told me it was against the law for me to be in the building because I was no longer on parole. So they took me up. I was able to grab one little bag, and then that was the day I became homeless. I would stay up for 3-4 days, walking all night, I actually would look for a bus stop to sit in. I didn't have a blanket. Didn't have a jacket, really a warm jacket, so I would look for places where I could get out of the wind, you know, to stay warm, or go down to the BART station where the warmth would come up between 12 and 4 once they closed. And then just, you know, wait for the BART to open and then sneak on BART, you know, ride the BART until you wake up. I was homeless for 8 weeks, which doesn't seem a lot compared to a lot of people, but I actually went through a lot of stuff during that time. Well, the most common people walking by, I just look at you like you have dirt on you, and they don't want to stop and speak. But most people, you know, they'll stereotype you. You know, like, why don't you get a job? I've never done this in my life, but, you know, I was hurting, I was hungry, you know, because maybe I would eat once a day. Some days I wouldn't eat at all. I took a sign, and I was like, please help. Anything is a blessing. God bless you. And I had this lady down by the Embarcadero, and she walked by me. She was a black lady, very nice. You know, and she stopped me. She goes, you know, can I get you something to eat? And she took me to Subway and bought me a foot-long sandwich and, you know, a coffee that morning. So, you know, and that really meant a lot.
What happened after the 8 weeks?
Mr. Cooks, he used to be the head deputy chief of parole. I called him and I would check in with him periodically, you know, even when I was homeless, and let him know how I was doing and stuff. So he told me one day, well, why don't you come back to the reentry service? Well, I said, well, look, they keep me out because I don't have the funding. You know, I don't say, he goes, I got you. He got me the funding, he got me back in. But I'm not supposed to be there, so they're trying to keep it real hush hush, quiet, quiet. Like when I went to St. Anthony's and they took a group picture, I couldn't be in the picture. Because, you know, they don't want me to be seen by CDC or who it is, you know. At any day, they could ask me to leave. I'm not sure of what's going to happen tomorrow. So that's why I pretty much learn to live in the now every day, you know, and just take it as it comes each day. Just keep pushing forward, you know, because I could go home today and be touted to be homeless again on the streets.
Cherry Fraser's story was produced by KLW's Jesse Rhodes. It's an excerpt from Stories Behind the Fog, Humanizing Homelessness in San Francisco, One Story at a Time. We're airing them all this week. You can find Cherry's oral history and photography from the project at KLW.org. Click Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Bay Area comic Daya Lakshmi Narayanan has shared the stage with the likes of Marc Maron and Janine Garofalo, and she's a regular contributor to the popular radio show Snap Judgment. But she didn't start out as a comedian. First, she got 2 degrees in urban planning, and then she was a venture capitalist in Silicon Valley. But at the office, she found herself cracking jokes all the time. Daya stopped by KALW Studios to talk with Nina Gensler-Debs about how she sharpened her comedy while working in the finance industry.
I know you've written or talked about how you used your ability to make people laugh, give you access to spaces or make spaces more comfortable for you that wouldn't have been otherwise. So I wanted to ask you a little bit about that and how you managed to use that element of your personality.
Yeah. So comedy for many people is about being an outsider. And even with someone who's, quote, mainstream, like a Louis C.K., he's not the conventionally attractive man. He's a single dad, which you don't hear about a lot. So he himself, just as a straight white man, is kind of an outsider. So the best comedians, whether it's race or gender expression or sexual orientation, feel different. And I learned early on that I was different. My parents were immigrants. I grew up in the South. I'm smaller than everyone else. So by being funny, I was able to access places and culture that I may not have been able to access. And I kept that as a skill set because it was disarming and it was surprising to people. So when I worked in the finance industry, I'm 5 feet tall for all the radio listeners who can't see me, and I don't weigh a lot. So when you're with a group of men who are all bigger and taller than you, who drink a pitcher of beer, and we're talking about, I don't even know, the Rays or the Ravens or the, I mean, I have no idea what these sports teams are. And when they're all talking about that, I have nothing to contribute. I'm like, did they get any yards? How was the kickoffs? So I would just make them laugh. And if they were inappropriate with me, I could take it and I would give it even harder, which probably you're not supposed to do if you're trained by HR properly. But it was my way of dominating these men. Mm-hmm. And then they were like, oh, man, okay. And so then they would start inviting me to breakfast meetings. They would discuss deals with me. They found me non-threatening, but scary, which is a good power dynamic to have if you're a small brown woman in the finance world.
Good combination. Did you grow up in a funny household, or was there somebody in your life growing up that you felt like was funny?
We like to say, my brother and I, that my mom is funny and my dad thinks he's funny. So my mom is the extrovert. My dad's the introvert. My mom is the social one. My mom does impressions of people, all our relatives. She makes people laugh. She's hilarious. She was inspired by her aunts who are really funny. So the women in my mom's side of the family all have like really big personalities. They tend to be curvy. They tend to be positive about their fatness. They tend to like to laugh, make others laugh. So I always grew up just believing that women were funny and in some cases funnier. I just thought my dad was a really smart guy, but he was a little bit boring, but I still loved him, and that my mom was a celebrity. So I never bought into the stereotype that we have about, are women funny? Can women be funny? My mom would always encourage us to be funny by laughing at us and also making us laugh.
What's her response to your jokes now?
So my parents go to bed at like 9:30 or 10. So sure. Coming to a comedy club is like a big night out for them. One time they came to a show that was at 5 p.m., which is never going to be good. When it's light outside, comedy doesn't work. And I did like a sociopolitical joke, which was a little bit over the heads of the audience. And then I heard this huge laugh from the back. My mom is falling out laughing so hard because she gets my humor. She's my mom. And I just had to stop and be like, thank you to my mom for the only person who got that joke about global politics. And so she not only likes my humor, she just laughs out loud. She tells me all the time that I'm funny. Sometimes it's like not believable, but she believes it. Like I asked her one time if she liked Chris Rock, who is one of my idols, of course. And she was like, Chris Rock is not funny. You are funnier. And I was like, well, that's not true, but thank you.
Thanks, Mom.
Yes.
Thanks, Mom.
Yes. So they're very loving and very supportive. And again, you didn't ask me this, but I think people are very surprised in American culture that immigrant parents can love and support you, even if you're not an engineer or a doctor. But I think it's not that uncommon. Like, they really just do love me for who I am, and I make them laugh. And sometimes I make them laugh at their expense, but they also make fun of me. So kind of giving each other, you know, crap is part of the way that we love each other.
Yeah. Do you feel like the comedy scene in the Bay Area feels different than, say, New York or L.A. or Savannah, Georgia, or anywhere else?
Yeah, I've performed in all those places. The Bay Area is unique in that there's a collection of really smart people who have often felt like outsiders, whether they're immigrants or they're running away from their families or they're part of the LGBT community. There's a real mix of people who really respond to smart, brainy, political, interesting comedy. And so I think that that's lovely to be able to have this breeding ground here where you can really innovate and try new things. I would also say that one of the most challenging places to perform is the Bay Area, too, because the audience doesn't know whether to laugh or to be empathetic, and sometimes they can be too empathetic. So I'll tell a joke about my own experience about race growing up in Alabama, being told something offensive and how I reacted to it. And I won't name the geography, but there are some parts of the Bay Area where you'll hear, oh, or, and I'm like, that's not a laugh. Don't make that noise. This is not group therapy. You're here to laugh. Or they'll clam up, or they'll be like, you know, oh my goodness, like, you know, I really marched with, you know, with the Occupy movement. I don't know if I can laugh at this line. You know, I'm really, and so it's like almost like people are not letting go and laughing for the sake of laughing. Whereas I think sometimes in other places people take the art form as it is, which is this is a human reaction. It's part of like your reptilian reaction. When you're laughing and you have your mouth open, there's something about the live experience that's communal and it brings people together. And laughing with like 400 people can be so cathartic. And if you don't like one comic, sorry, maybe there'll be another one you like, but keep trying.
That was comedian Daya Lakshmi Narayanan speaking with KLW's Nina Gensler-Debs. Daya will host The Moth tonight at Freight and Salvage in Berkeley, and she'll be performing at She Who Laughs Last later this month. For more details about that and her upcoming shows, go to KLW.org and click Cross Currents. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Babau.